Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Prostate Cancer. This is a two-part series, and today's program is Advances in the Treatment of Prostate Cancer. This is part one. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 534 participants, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. This program has been supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Services, LLC. This program was also supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen. So we really want to thank both of them for their support of our program today. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care, and in those materials is information about our speakers and the topics that will be covered, and there is information also about all of the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs that you would like us to offer going forward? So please do tell us what you'd like us to offer going forward. We also do have a part two to this series, which will be coming up in a couple of weeks on October 12th, on dealing with side effects more specifically, although we'll be addressing it in part today. So it gives you a chance to tell us what you'd like us to do going forward. So please do keep that in mind. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I'd like to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is Associate Attending Physician, Genitourinary Oncology Service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to address an overview of prostate cancer, including standard of care, new treatment approaches, the management of other chronic conditions, and African-American and Hispanic men's access to coordinated care. I now want to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to update you on all the new and exciting issues and drugs that are out there in the world of prostate cancer. I'd like to start off really by taking the initiative to tell you one very important thing about prostate cancer, and that is we have more treatments out there now than we've ever had. And the good news is that for the first time in many years, we have four new drugs that have already been FDA approved and really are out there in prime time. The standards of care for treating patients who have localized prostate cancer, that is, cancer that has not escaped the confines of the gland itself, still remain surgery and radiation. And people are easily put into long-term remission, if not cure, with these techniques. However, it is still very common to see patients who have, unfortunately, failed conventional therapies, either surgery, radiation, or both, and even the institution of hormonal therapies. And while patients can still maintain an excellent quality of life despite the fact that their disease has returned, nevertheless, this is probably the most exciting time to have prostate cancer, because not only will people have improved quality of life overall with new treatments, but their overall ability to fight the cancer has really been markedly improved. I'd like to take a moment now and talk about at least four drugs that have now been in the marketplace and how they are impacting on the cancer very favorably, as well as two new drugs that are going to likely be approved in the forthcoming months. So for patients who have failed multiple hormonal manipulations, the hormones being a GnRH analog such as leuprolide or Lupron otherwise known, Eligard, Zoladex, in addition to a variety of different anti-androgens or blockers of testosterone, which go by a variety of names, there is still a lot that's out there. very often, if one hormonal manipulation doesn't work, we go on to second or third drugs that very often will. And that can buy us several years before we really need to change treatment. People are often very concerned about chemotherapy and saying, oh my gosh, if my hormones don't work, is chemo the next step? And interestingly, you know, chemotherapy is there. It works, it improves quality of life, and it controls pain, and really does a lot for the patient to get people back into the workforce and back to really living a good quality of life. But what has changed is that with chemotherapy, people unfortunately give it a very bad rep. I personally use chemotherapy when the PSA is doubling or tripling so quickly that no matter what kind of impact I'm trying to do on the cancer, meaning changing the hormonal therapies, for example, I don't have impact. The second would be someone who is just not thriving, someone who is losing appetite, losing weight. They just don't have that energy. And the third would be someone who has disease at multiple sites, for example, in bone that is causing significant pain. And the only way I would be able to get them out of pain would be to radiate a significant amount of their bone and, of course, possibly compromise their bone marrow, which has all the blood reserves that we need to maintain a healthy life. So what often happens is that if patients have one of these three concerns, then I will start chemotherapy. However, we are now finding that patients may end up getting chemotherapy a little bit later. We started out recently by having the first drug ever approved for immunotherapy. The name is Cipolucil-T or Provenge by the Dendrion Corporation. This is a cellular product therapy that is derived from your own blood cells. The cells are removed through a machine called leukapheresis. They are then incubated with a protein product to sensitize the cells, and then the cells after 48 hours are returned to the patient. And this was the first treatment of an immune therapy that was given to patients that was FDA approved based on certain survival endpoints and benefits, I should say. So while this has been going very well for patients who have not as yet received chemotherapy and have no evidence of significant pain, nevertheless, more recently, another drug just came into the forefront called Zytiga. The other name for it is abiraterone, and this is a drug that was probably the fastest accrued oral drug in development for prostate cancer, having accrued over 1,000 patients in literally less than 1 year. This drug is hormone-like. It blocks a certain pathway in the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland is this little P-shaped organ on top of your kidney that regulates your interaction with your environment and the ability to make the different sex steroids, such as estrogen and testosterone. But more importantly, this drug, as an oral drug, works very well in patients who have metastatic disease and has actually been shown to improve quality of life as well as control the disease for months to years. The indication for this drug thus far has been to be given after one has failed docetaxel, which is the standard chemotherapy for prostate cancer. However, more recently, and based on significant data that was presented at our national meetings in oncology, more and more of this cases of patients who have progressive disease but have not yet received chemotherapy are receiving the Zytiga. It's a very safe drug. Major side effects is that one's potassium level could go down a bit or one could exacerbate one's blood pressure, but very user-friendly both in the pre- and post-chemotherapy state. Very recently, meaning within the last several weeks, MDV-3100, the other name for it is Xtandi, X-T-A-N-D-I, is an oral drug that was also approved for patients in the post-chemotherapy setting and ultimately will be used prior to chemotherapy over time. This is a drug that is similar to a drug that many patients who have had prostate cancer have had, known as Casodex, but this is much more potent and works through a completely different mechanism of action. Easy to tolerate, can cause a little bit of fatigue, but in general is part of the armamentarium for patients whose disease has not responded either to chemotherapy or even Zytiga. And what we will see as the year goes on is that we will be able to ultimately move the placement of these drugs earlier in the disease setting, and we'll be probably using this a lot more interchangeably. So those patients who have failed docetaxel, of course, as I mentioned, we have Zytiga, we have Xtandi, and there is a second-line chemotherapy that for the first time was approved for prostate cancer by the name of Gevtana, J-E-V-T-A-N-A. The other name for it is cabazitaxel. And this is a very safe drug and has been shown to really improve quality of life for patients who have failed prior chemotherapy. Now, while all of this is well and good, there are still concerns that people have regarding their symptomatic disease, for example, bone pain. And currently under evaluation for approval is a drug called alpha-radin. The other name for it is radium-223. This is the same radium that Marie Curie discovered many, many years ago. And this is a drug that may likely be approved for improving quality of life as it pertains to pain. There's another drug that is out there, which is a drug that has exquisite specificity for certain signaling pathways within the cancer. Its name is cabozantinib, or XL184, and this is a drug that we are all eagerly awaiting, as it has really shown significant anti-tumor responses. So we'll be looking forward to seeing how this goes forward with the FDA in the next several months. One of the issues that we often do not address is that patients come to us with long-standing medical problems, hypertension, diabetes, coronary artery disease, and while I'm often flattered that my patients think that I can be their primary care or physician or internist, nevertheless, my specialty is medical oncology, and it's extremely important for us to really maintain relationships with the patient's outside physicians, in particular the primary care or the internist. And the reason is that very often we want to make sure that giving certain drugs within the clinical setting is appropriate in the milieu of the patient, meaning hypertension, diabetes, and we certainly don't want to exacerbate other ongoing health issues. Many patients come to us from underserved communities with metastatic disease at the get-go. And I think it's very important to know that even if a patient does not present with localized disease but has metastatic disease that is either symptomatic or is just there and is not causing any problems, we probably have more drugs now in our armamentarium than we've ever had before. On another note, keep in mind that hormonal therapy is difficult sometimes for a patient to tolerate. It can cause mood swings, a little bit of depression, sometimes some tearfulness or short-temperedness. And in addition to pre-existing comorbidities such as hypertension, diabetes, and the like, adding on a little bit of extra weight due to fluid retention or accelerated osteoporosis or even anemia, hot flushes, loss of libido as a result of hormonal therapy is certainly not something that we should mitigate. Hormones can exacerbate blood pressure as a result of more fluid retention. It can cause more weight, and that can certainly impact on fluid retention as well as high blood pressure. So my point is that while as medical oncologists we bear the burden of taking care of cancer itself, we always need to be in contact with another physician who is sharing in the care of our patient. And I think it's very important for patients who are out there to know to bring their medication lists. Very often patients come and say, well, you know, and I say, well, I don't know, and they say, well, you know, aren't you an internist? I am an internist, but it's important for people to know their medications, to bring either the bottles or a list of the medication and the doses. Somebody telling me they take a green pill tells me absolutely nothing. There are more green pills than little green men on Mars. So as far as I'm concerned, you really need to bring these bottles with you along with the doses, and it's extremely important. We're all here to help you, and I'm just one little small cog in the wheel, and I will go right back to Carolyn now for our next speaker. Thank you all for listening. Carolyn?
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin. That was a wonderful tour de force, wonderful presentation. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. We already are getting questions from some of our online participants, so this is really exciting. Our next speaker is Dr. Zalewski, Dr. Michael Zalewski. Dr. Zalewski is professor of radiation oncology. He's chief brachytherapy service, Department of Radiation Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We're delighted to have Dr. Zalewski with us today, and he's going to address the role of the radiation oncologist in your care and the role of radiation treatment throughout your treatment for prostate cancer. Dr. Zalewski, please.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and it's a real pleasure to be here as well. I was asked to discuss some of the really important roles that radiation therapy has to play in the management of prostate cancer. And as Dr. Slovin eloquently described, the treatment of prostate cancer is a spectrum. In our institution, we call it as states of the different parts of the disease, and in general, it's a slow-growing disease, and it has different stages associated with it. As Dr. Slovin previously explained, for the early stages of prostate cancer, the primary modes of therapy that are well recognized in the treatment of earlier stages of the disease include surgery and different forms of radiation therapy. And those results with surgery or non-surgical therapy appear to show long-term, even excellent results. One of the things we've seen over the last 5 and 10 years in the evolution of radiation treatments is the extraordinary sophistication of the delivery of radiation treatments. There are many patients who tell me that they remember from their parents or grandparents what they went through when it came to radiation treatments. And radiotherapy nowadays is so much more sophisticated, so much more targeted, that the side effects are significantly less. And it allows us as radiation oncologists to deliver the radiation in such a precise way that is fortunately associated with much better results than we've seen before. One of the critical aspects of treating even advanced forms of prostate cancer that have not yet spread, critical ingredients for the success of the therapy, in other words, we've learned has been the delivery of very high doses of radiation, now able to be done in safe ways because of the high precision associated with the sophisticated computer planning and targeting of the radiation treatments. Not only do we deliver treatments which we call external radiotherapy from a high energy machine called a linear accelerator to deliver the high dose, but there are other forms of delivering the high doses of radiation treatments, such as stereotactic radiosurgery, where we can deliver, instead of the traditional 10 weeks of daily treatment, we can now deliver treatments in 5 sessions only, once again attributed to the fact that we can target the radiation somewhere accurately. Another form of therapy that people often ask about is proton therapy, and studies have not yet been clearly demonstrating a benefit for protons, but it is a very high accurate form of treatment, and I believe in the years ahead this may be demonstrating for us even better results with improved ways of targeting the proton therapy. Beside high-dose radiation, which is good for locally advanced diseases of the prostate, another important component is the use of hormones, as Dr. Slovin had described, together with the radiation treatments. And many studies now have demonstrated many years later that the combination of hormone therapy together with radiation when it is delivered to the prostate is associated with excellent results long term. Another form of radiation therapy, which is again because of computer generated sophisticated targeting techniques, is brachytherapy, which are what many people know as seed implant therapy. And especially in the management of more advanced forms of the disease, again, when it's not yet spread, it is apparent that the use of brachytherapy in combination with radiation treatments, external radiation treatments, is associated also with excellent results. So far, to summarize what I've said before we move on to metastatic disease or disease that had spread to other areas outside of the prostate, there have been significant advances in the delivery of external radiation, or brachytherapy is internal radiation. And because of sophisticated targeting techniques, we now are able to see less side effects associated with the radiation, and once again, improved outcomes as well. These targeted techniques have allowed us to not only precisely deliver the radiation, but it has also, in some cases, allowed us to condense these 10-week courses of treatment in selected cases to shorter courses, which can span over a period of a week and a half. There is also an important aspect of radiation in the management of recurrent disease. Recurrent disease, such as when the disease comes back as in the form of a rising PSA blood test level after surgery. This means that there may be some active cells within the prostate region where the prostate was removed from, or in the lymph node regions. And in selected situations, it is well known that radiation can be helpful when it is directed to the prostate bed, as we call it, or the region where the prostate used to be, as this may harbor the delivery of some microscopic cells. And those, again, those microscopic cells could be the source of where the PSA is arising from. So radiation treatment, as we call it, salvage radiotherapy to hopefully eliminate any microscopic cellular activity where the prostate used to be, and to try to reduce the PSA from its rise as people are being followed after surgery, could be a very useful tool in the management of disease before it has had a chance to spread. Studies are ongoing now when we are treating recurrent prostate cancer, whether hormonal therapy added to the course of treatment could be helpful or not, and these studies are important and ongoing. Finally, there is a very important role for radiation treatments in the palliation of a disease that has spread to bone. Very often, disease that is spread to bone can become painful sites of disease requiring higher doses of narcotics, and sometimes, and obviously, could be debilitating. In cases where the disease is in areas of bone that are called weight-bearing, such as in the femur or in the hip, and there is a risk of fracture, we often get the opinions of our orthopedic surgeon and colleagues to evaluate whether there is indeed a fracture or not, because in those situations, it's important to address the fracture before delivering any kind of radiation. If there is no evidence of fracture, then radiation treatments given classically and traditionally over a period of 2 weeks is very often effective in minimizing and significantly decreasing the pain associated with lesions or growths that are found within the bone. And once again, taking advantage of some of the very sophisticated targeting techniques that I talked about earlier, stereotactic radiosurgery, there has been an increasing and a recognized new role for delivering very high and pinpointed doses to the lesions in the bone, and not giving it a 2-week course, but sometimes 1 or 3 treatments to limited areas of the bone, which, number one, doesn't include a large amount of marrow, a concern that Dr. Slovin appropriately raised. Here, the bone growths can be targeted to a very specific and limited area. In addition, these new approaches have been associated with some very significant success rates as well in really decreasing to a very high level the not only the pain, but even the improvement on some of the scans. So in summary, we've talked here at this time about some of the not only sophisticated forms of treatment, but the wide range of radiation usage through different parts of the disease. And of course, seeing your radiation oncologist to determine whether you're a candidate for these kinds of treatments and working together with the medical oncologist and urologist is also very important, of course, as well as the internist. Thank you for your attention today.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Zalewski, for a very comprehensive presentation and really for giving our audience today a very, very clear understanding of the role of radiation oncology and how it can really benefit in their treatment and so how important it is. So thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Natalie Morrell. Dr. Morrell is assistant attending physician, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She's also with the Pain and Palliative Care Service and Department of Medicine. She's assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College. And Dr. Morrell is going to address tips on managing side effects and pain, so really to help you understand how that can be managed, communicating with your healthcare team, its importance, and the quality of life concerns that you may have. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Morrell.
Thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me to speak today. Hello, everybody. I'm going to talk about symptom and treatment-related side effects and communicating with your healthcare team. So symptoms and treatment-related side effects can be seen at any stage of prostate cancer. In a study of 400 men during 8 months from the early in the disease trajectory, it seemed that fatigue and emotional distress are seen most commonly early in the disease. Pain, fatigue, emotional distress, urinary, sexual, and bowel dysfunction were the factors that were evaluated in this study. I would like to go over the side effects and symptoms that are attributed to hormonal ablation treatment, the hormonal treatment described by Dr. Slovin, in more details, because these are some of the reasons why we in Pain and Palliative Care Service see prostate cancer patients with uncontrolled symptoms. Androgen deficiency or age-related decline in serum testosterone has become a primary, a popular topic in the medical literature over the last few years. And these are the cancellation of symptoms related to lack of androgens that are seen often in prostate cancer patients. They are hot flashes with night sweats, decreased generalized feeling of well-being, osteoporosis, fatigue, depressed mood, and others. The main message that I want to convey today is not only you need to treat your prostate cancer, but your symptoms or side effects of hormonal treatment need to be addressed separately. And there are medications and effective strategies to treat them. I'll start with hot flashes. So hot flashes are reported in 60 to 80% of patients, and half of men experiencing hot flashes will have them 5 years later, and 40% continue to have them at 8 years. Night sweats that sometimes come with hot flashes can disturb sleep pattern and lead to patients feeling tired, irritable, and some social isolation and marital issues because of behaviors surrounding night sweats. Again, the most important message is that you have to communicate to your medical team if this is an issue for you. And there are the treatment options that are usually employed are antidepressant medications such as Effexor, Prozac, and other inhibitors of serotonin reuptake and norepinephrine reuptake. Medication dose may need to be adjusted, and it may take a few days to a couple of weeks to find the right dose and the right medication. But these are the effective medications with low side effect profile. Another group is gabapentin, neurontin, or pregabalin, or Lyrica, that are used to treat a variety of neurological disorders. They have been reported to be helpful to control hot flashes. And then alternative medicine therapies a few out of them, acupuncture seems to be effective, but it's a lot more costly and takes longer, up to 10 sessions. The other side effect of hormonal therapy is osteoporosis and sarcopenia. Osteoporosis is the thinning of the bones, and given the clinical significance of osteoporotic fracture in men, it's routinely screened for and treated. But in addition to what the oncologist does for you, lifestyle modifications such as smoking cessation, no more than moderate alcohol intake, and weight-bearing exercises are very effective in preventing and treatment of your osteoporosis. And the same goes for sarcopenia, which is a loss of muscle mass and strength that occurs with normal aging and is accelerated by hormonal ablation treatment. It's really important to prevent and treat osteoporosis and muscle wasting, because these lead to impaired functional performance, increasing physical dependence, risk for falls, especially in the elderly patients. So exercises appear to be the best treatment to combat sarcopenia and osteoporosis as far as what the patient can do for himself. The other issue is depression or adjustment disorder. Early in the disease, when the diagnosis of cancer comes in your door, it can be very stressful, and usually especially it gets worse when people get advanced disease. And this is the most stressful time of most of people's life. So we recommend that the patients report their symptoms, their depressed mood, to their clinician to get appropriate referral and treatment. You don't have to be depressed. There are medications to help with depression and adjustment disorder. Overall, quality of life of men with prostate cancer has become an important topic in the literature recently, and for good reason. Prostate cancer is one of the most common cancers in the United States, and given its long natural history, patients live for many years after diagnosis. And quality of life has to do with those symptoms that can be difficult to quantify, like sense of well-being, mental health, perception of physical health, specific side effects, including urinary sexual function and fatigue. There are medications to address each one of those symptoms, and support, group support, social group support, and medical help to address the quality of life in general. I want to talk about pain specifically. Pain is not uncommon in prostate cancer. It's more common in the advanced stages. Up to 90% of patients with the advanced phase of their illness may have pain. And it can be caused either by cancer itself or cancer treatment, or could be unrelated to cancer pain, to cancer, such as low back pain and arthritis, knee pain, etc. There are very effective medications for pain. Pain is a signal that you need to report to your physician, and it is physician's task to discover and treat the cause of pain and the pain itself, to determine whether or not the underlying cause is treatable, whether it means something very significant for your function, and whether anything needs to be done urgently. The physician would also arrange for pain consultation if appropriate and palliative care. While the urologist will be the main treating physician for most of the patients, in some cases, a referral to pain specialist and multidisciplinary team involvement may be helpful to coordinate the care based on the patient's preferences and goals of care. Pain management involves mainly direct anti-cancer therapy, such as androgen deprivation that we just discussed, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, as well as medications that are specifically prescribed for pain. And they're usually non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or opioids. We use opioids very freely, and most patients have adequate pain control on relatively low doses of opioids. If doses are escalated above the comfort level of the oncologist, the referral to pain specialist is made for the second opinion or to adjust the medication regimen. We use oxycodone, fentanyl, we use methadone, commonly for prostate cancer-related pain, levorphanol and other opioids available. We also use adjuvant analgesics, again going back to antidepressant medications and anti-seizure medications with good effect. Prostate cancer-related pain in most cases can be managed very effectively, but if it requires careful monitoring where a balance should be found between pain relief and potential side effects of treatment and quality of life. You need to communicate with your team. Your doctor and nurse may be assessing your symptoms, but their thinking may be different from yours. And unless you report your symptoms very clearly, your team will not know about them. Some patients in our practice are trying to be quote-unquote good patients and are stoic and prefer not to complain to their team, quote-unquote, too much, and they don't want to burden the physician or the nurse, but I would like to encourage you to be very truthful and direct with your clinical team and the oncologist. Considering the changes in healthcare and short-time visits, sometimes patients with clinicians, some of the clinicians started to use questionnaires in standard form to record your symptoms. Please make sure you take time and effort to fill them out truthfully. This would guide your doctor. In addition to that, sometimes bringing a family member, a wife, children, or a friend is very helpful to share to describe the burden of the symptoms that you may be underreporting or not comfortable discussing. Please empower your doctor and the nurse to make the best decisions by communicating your needs. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Morrell, for an excellent presentation and really for highlighting the importance of everyone reporting their symptoms and talking to their doctors about any symptom they may have or any pain or discomfort, because it sounds like from your description that there's so much that can be done for any symptom or discomfort that anyone has. It's really it's so important to share that information with your treating healthcare team. It's very important. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers, and now we do have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all our speakers on board. And we're going to start, and Stephanie will explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to take as many of your questions as we can. If we do not get to your question, and I'll repeat this again later on, you can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our social work staff will address your questions. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit a question by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Sandra S. Your line is open.
Thank you. Two-part question about Lupron. After radical prostatectomy and 15 years of non-detectable PSA, can Lupron be safely stopped for a while? And the second part of that is, does Lupron cause muscle wasting in and around the eye, for example, the orbit fat being lost and the resulting ptosis and deep-set eyes? Is that a Lupron side effect?
Thank you for that question, Dr. Slovin, would you address that question?
Yes. Two questions here. One is the side effects of the GnRH agonist Lupron. You know, most of the people have complained of muscle wasting, usually in the muscles of the legs and the arms. To my knowledge, there's nothing that's been described of losing muscle tone anywhere else in the body. I suppose it's really a theoretical possibility, but in the hundreds of patients that I've seen, I've not usually witnessed that. I think what happens is perhaps over time, people tend to lose a little bit of, there's a change in their distribution, and as you know, on Lupron, people tend to get a little bit of a pot belly. So what you start to see is a change in the body habitus, the way the body looks, and it certainly can change over time with weight loss and just the way the body is responding to Lupron. So while it's not a direct effect, there's a potential for it, but I would say it's really an indirect effect of the treatment as opposed to the direct one. In terms of stopping Lupron, it wasn't clear to me whether or not Lupron was on for the last several years after the prostatectomy, but if it was, it can be stopped. What often happens is that the longer you are on Lupron, the less likely that the brain and the testes can reconnect, and sometimes patients may be permanently castrated, meaning that they never are able to get their testosterone levels back to normal. There, every now and then, there's always somebody where you stop it. It's perfectly safe in stopping it, but of course, there's a discussion. Unfortunately, I don't know all the details of this case, but if this is something that you want to do, then it should really be discussed with your physician, your urologist or oncologist, as they can give you the best discussion of the benefits of risk of either continuing or stopping.
Carolyn. Thank you, Dr. Slovin. And it's so important what Dr. Slovin has said, that we want you to then take this information back to your treating healthcare team, because they indeed know all of the details of your, all your medical records, have access to all that information. But we hope this is a helpful guide as you talk with your physician. Now, we have an excellent question from one of our online participants, and the question is, what are your recommendations for treating fatigue for patients with advanced prostate cancer? So I'm going to ask Dr. Morrell if you could address that, and Dr. Slovin as well.
Mm-hmm. I can start. Anemia is often a part of the prostate cancer disease or treatment, and so correction of anemia or other causes that can cause fatigue would be very important. Low-dose steroids could be used, and we also use Ritalin, methylphenidate, as a psychostimulant to help with fatigue. But before adding any medications, I would review your medication list and see if there are any medications that could be replaced by similar agents without causing, sedation as one of the side effects. Some of antidepressants are more sedating than others, etc. So auditing your medication list would be important, checking hemoglobin level, checking thyroid function, and if anything needed to be added, we would consider steroids, very low-dose steroid, or Ritalin, if appropriate. But again, I would defer to your primary oncologist to make their recommendation.
Thank you. Could you just comment a bit more, Dr. Morrell, about the thyroid function? I don't know if everyone understands that, how that would impact.
Fatigue is a very nonspecific symptom, and it could signify multiple diseases, multiple other issues. For example, it's not uncommon to have low thyroid function, and that could cause fatigue. Smoking can cause fatigue, COPD, chronic lung conditions, etc. It probably should be your medical history and medication list should be reviewed with you in clinic to see what else can cause fatigue. If there are no correctable causes, then some of the medications could be added to address it.
Thank you. And Dr. Slovin, did you want to add anything?
No, Dr. Morrell is right on point. I would just add two very small points, is that very often people will take sleep aids, and they wake up the next morning, and they are absolutely lethargic. So sleeping aids, either over-the-counter or prescribed by another doctor, can be very, very dangerous. That's number one. The second is that patients can often be very deconditioned. In other words, if you're not feeling well, if you've had pain, you may be sitting for longer periods of time, and when you get up, you're just even more exhausted than when you started out. The third is sometimes people sleep by day and they're awake by night, and all of this just change in their normal scheduling can make them very, very tired. So as Dr. Morrell said, it's very multifactorial. First and foremost, we always want to check the medication list, because even pain medication can make people very tired. And if you're constipated and you don't have any degree of regularity, all of these even smaller things can contribute to a sense of just not feeling well.
Excellent. This is very comprehensive. Thank you. Our next question is a general question from one of our online participants. And the question is, what type of tests or kind of ongoing tests should be done for men who have prostate cancer? What is their kind of follow-up tests that they should be having? Dr. Slovin, I know it's a general question, so if, just to
well,
outline some.
The best I can do, Carolyn, is give you a general answer. For patients who have nothing more than a rising PSA that is being monitored, a lot depends on how fast that PSA is going up. So if it doubles or triples in a very short period of time, let's say 6 months or less, and I'm not talking about going from 2 to 4 or from 0.1 to 0.2, it usually means that there will be a change in the scans within the course of a year. So remember that a PSA that goes from 2 to 4 does not mean that you have twice the amount of disease at 4 compared with what you had at 2. It's a measure of activity. So I usually, for these patients, depending on the level of the PSA, I might recommend a bone scan and a CAT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, either once or twice a year, depending on the level of aggressiveness of their cancer. For somebody who's on therapy, at least every 3 or 4 months, I might be doing imaging for one reason, which is to evaluate the response to therapy. So it really depends where you are in the disease schema. That would make me either evaluate sooner or later. There are some newer imaging modalities known as PET scan, positron emission tomography, which is like a CAT scan that has a superimposed radioactive component to it, and it looks at activity of your cancer based on the cancer's ability to use a specific kind of metabolic pathway to use glucose or sugar. And what's very interesting about it is that we find it very helpful in looking at patients who have received, for example, chemotherapy, and pre and post imaging, you can actually see a change in the metabolic activity or the activity of the cancer as it responds to therapy. So depending on where you are, what you're being treated with, that would really dictate the level of specificity of the scans. But in general, bone scan and CAT scan are the two modalities that we use most frequently.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And our next question is for Dr. Zalewski. It's a question that I think probably comes up a lot. It's from one of our online participants as well. Can radioactivity after radiation therapy hurt my partner?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's often asked. And I think we need to distinguish between the two types of radiation treatments. External beam radiation treatments, which come from a linear accelerator or a machine, does not render the patient in any way radioactive. And while nobody is present in the room during those 1 to 2 minutes of treatment, immediately afterwards, if we were to place a Geiger counter as a measure of any kind of radioactivity, we would detect absolutely nothing, because there is no residual radiation or radioactivity in the patient. However, with seed implants, where we place radioactive pellets within the prostate, for instance, those pellets are active, depending upon the isotope used, for several months. And in those cases, during the first 2 to 3 months, or sometimes up to 5 or 6 months, again, depending on the type of radioactive pellet used, there could be some radioactivity that can be just detected, but detected enough that we generally make recommendations that small children shouldn't be on the laps of individuals who have just had a seed implant, in other words, for prolonged periods of time. And the spouse can certainly... the patient can be together with his spouse without any concerns. However, we do make a recommendation that during the first 1 to 2 months, for prolonged periods of time where one partner is close to the other, and we're talking about greater than 4 or 5 hours uninterrupted, that should be avoided. But after 3 months in general, this does not pose any kind of a safety hazard. And if there are any questions that do come up, a radiation safety officer, who is often somebody within the hospital or the institution where these seed implants are performed, can make very simple measurements to reassure any individual who has these kinds of procedures about any guidelines or recommendations.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I think that that is so informative to our audience. And although we can't hear everybody, I think there's a collective sigh of relief that people kind of have a better understanding of this. So thank you so much, Dr. Zlefsky. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Diana B. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you very much. I was wanting to know, my dad just recently had been diagnosed with prostate cancer. They did do the test and said it had metastasized in his hip bones. What I was wondering is, he is seeing his urologist only. His urologist has said he wouldn't send him out to an oncologist as of yet. I wanted to make sure that would be the proper way in doing that, we shouldn't go to the next level and maybe even see an oncologist ourselves. Also, he was castrated as what his choice was instead of doing the hormonal shots. And what they were talking about is if his hormone level doesn't decrease, that they would take his adrenal gland as the next step. And I was wondering if that would be the right decision.
Diana, thank you for these excellent questions. And Dr. Slovin, could you address this in a general way?
Yes. The standard of care for patients who have disease that has metastasized to bone or to lymph node would be to treat them with hormonal therapy, which, as you know, will cause the disconnection of the signal between the brain and the testes and essentially will render a man castrated and with symptoms that are consistent with a chemical-induced menopause, very similar to what a woman goes through. Whether or not to use hormonal therapy to do it versus surgical castration is a very personal choice. The standard operating procedure for many of us has been to use hormonal therapy because it gives us flexibility of going on and off the therapy. So for a man who has metastatic disease, there's a greater than 90% chance that the patient will go into remission, at which point one could always do a shot of radiation to consolidate the treatment to the bone, or just stop the hormones and then just use it on an on and off type of way. It's not considered to be standard, but for an older person who may be more symptomatic and easily rendered perhaps a little weaker as a result of the hormones, this is a very perfectly acceptable way. Using surgical castration is still acceptable. We don't see it all that often anymore. And one of the issues is that you don't have the flexibility in going on and off. When anybody undergoes castration, the setting of disease in bone, it's always helpful for them to have something to keep their bones strong and help the bones heal. And there are a variety of different drugs that are out there now, a drug called Xgeva, which is a little needle that's given once a month to the under the skin, or a drug called zoledronic acid, which is an intravenous that can be given either monthly or every 3 months, can keep the bones strong. Now, if the testosterone level is still not at low levels, which I find a little peculiar, one certainly can add a pill called Casodex, which may bring the PSA level down as well. But I think the issue is it's a little atypical. We would not be routinely doing an adrenalectomy. I would make sure that, number one, that there was no laboratory error. And the other thing that you bring mention to is there's no such thing as being too early or too late in seeing a medical oncologist. I have patients who see me before they make a final determination as to whether they wish to go for radiation or surgery. And I think it's very good at the get-go to have a medical oncologist on board, so that a medical oncologist could be prepared and know the patient, know the family, and have some input. That's the person who can, with whom you should be sharing your care, just as you would be sharing your care with a primary care physician. So there is certainly no threat to anybody if a medical oncologist is on board. In fact, in the old days, we used to be the last people on board, which made things very unpleasant because sometimes patients really needed to see the doctor who's an oncologist and just get a different perspective. So I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with getting perspective and perhaps just a second opinion so that if anything does change, that doctor is on board and can facilitate the care of your father a lot faster.
And it's always, I think what Dr. Slovin is really saying is it's always a good idea to involve the multidisciplinary team, which includes the medical oncologist, critically important. And it is okay also, maybe we should just comment on just seeking a second opinion in terms of making these decisions.
Sure. It's very common these days for people to get second opinions from a second or even a third medical oncologist. Many people are very concerned that they're offending the doctor. I consider it to be part of the standard of care these days. No one, very often in communities, all the doctors know one another. They do not take it amiss. We want our patients to be satisfied. And frankly, we often work together. It's not uncommon for one patient, if they're dissatisfied at the moment and seeing one colleague, to go to another and then go back later on to the original doctor. So no one should be worried about that. I think it's important for you to be comfortable with the healthcare team and comfortable with the recommendations.
Well, thank you very much. An excellent question, Diana, and a lovely question to actually end our call with, but just that importance of really having that loyalty really to yourself and really seeing the best team that you can assemble, and that obviously includes all the people that we've had on the call today to help with any kind of concern that you may have involving a medical oncologist, getting a second opinion, involving other doctors can be very helpful. Well, I want to thank our speakers. They've been really terrific. I want to remind you that, of course, this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. So with this in mind, I just want to kind of remind all of you that we have at Cancer Care a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services. And that means someone to talk to, so counseling services. We also provide support groups, both on the telephone and online. We offer practical and financial assistance. And we have, of course, these workshops that we offer, these workshops over the phone or as webcasts. And we also, of course, have all types of materials and booklets that you can access and fact sheets from Cancer Care. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with prostate cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And we are simply a phone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE. And also our website is www.cancercare.org. And we have a part two to this series dealing with the side effects of prostate cancer treatments. So more extensive discussion, again, of these topics that we've addressed today on October 12th. So I welcome you all to sign up for that if you haven't, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.